Hi, I'm Natasha Moore from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear the Q&A session that followed Nick Spencer's 2018 lecture, titled, Where Did I Come From? Christianity, Secularism, and the Individual. You can hear his lecture in an earlier episode of this podcast, but here's Nick Spencer with Simon Smart, digging a bit deeper into the topic.
Just to begin with, it's not a very popular idea that you're presenting, that you presented in your book, the important role that Christianity's played in establishing many of the things that we enjoy in the West. What's been the response to your book, generally?
I think you're right, it's not a particular popular argument. It was one of the reasons why my book sells in tens of copies sometimes, really. honestly, Christians like it. That's not going to surprise you. I have had a more positive and thoughtful response from non-Christians, even some very secular-minded non-Christians, to it. I guess the most significant challenge I've faced, I mean, there are historical challenges, which are quite properly put, but the most significant challenge I've faced is, are you making a historical point or a normative point? In other words, is this just, I can accept, as one editor of a British newspaper said, I can actually accept what historical story you're telling me, but we are where we are now, and I don't see that as having a great deal of relevance for the future. Can we just carry on, even if we throw away our Christianity? Well, can't we just sustain tolerance and equality and so on and so forth? And I'm regularly pushed to try and make that apocalyptic point that, you know, we throw Christianity away and planes will fall from the sky. That is a tricky issue, because I do believe it's important. I do believe that ideas matter. But I also believe there are some practices, science would be a very good example, that might have their roots in Christian thought, but become self-sustaining. And it's an interesting and very difficult question to try and pull apart those that might be self-sustaining now that we are where we are, and those that might need, if you like, ongoing watering from a Christian anthropological view.
Yeah, so it doesn't say anything about the truth of Christianity, and is it just a case of, you know, giving credit where it's due? You think it's a bit more than that?
It's certainly a case of giving credit where it's due, and also, as an aside, it's probably a case of putting a card on the table in the contemporary public debate. I am an Orwellophile. I love the novels and the letters and the essays and the laundry lists of George Orwell, and he famously said, I paraphrase, he who controls the past controls the present, he who controls the present controls the future. Well, if you write Christianity out of our past, and in some ways out of our present, it makes a non-Christian future a great deal easier. So there's no such thing as history in that regard. History isn't over, it's not even history, as someone once famously said. So it is a historical argument, but by being a historical argument, it is also a contemporary argument, and I hope it gets people to think about their own roots, if you like, why they believe what they believe. And repeatedly I come across responses that aren't as examined as you might expect them to be.
So and think through the implications of belief, right? Some questions coming through, so let's have a go at some of them. A quick one, did Pinker concede any of your points? It seems like you're kind of, at least in the last part of his book, completely at odds.
It was far too much of a love-in, really. Well, he did, actually. And to his credit, he said to me afterwards, can you send me a couple of things you've written? I'd be very interested to see what his next book is like. I'm not exactly holding my breath. But he actually, first of all, when he said the argument, everything from the Enlightenment, and I replied, Statute of Monopoly, 1623, and his initial response straight back was, well, of course, you know, the Enlightenment drew on a lot of stuff that was going on beforehand, and I thought, yes.
Again, Pinker makes the case for progress, that we have made real progress, and presumably with the thought that things are getting better and will continue to. How do you respond to that idea?
I'm actually persuaded by the arguments and progress. I made a mistake in the lecture. I'm a glass half empty person rather than a glass half full person. Pinker makes a very strong case. In actual fact, to his credit, Pinker doesn't say that progress is automatic. The reason he wrote the book, I think, is effectively he's worried about trends, political and intellectual trends in the last generation or so, and he's making the argument for progress on the basis of there having been progress. So not even he would say it was inevitable. I would say I'm hopeful rather than optimistic, if you draw the distinction.
Okay. All this talk of European Enlightenment and the West could be thought of as culturally superior. That might be a concern in terms of the way you're framing the argument.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I did a radio debate with somebody today that I think has been broadcast on Sunday when she made exactly the same point. And I think the critical response to that is that you have to pull apart the West. It's not as if unanimously everybody who lived in the West at a certain time decided that political toleration or equality or the rule of law was a good thing and then peacefully exported it to the rest of the grateful world. Didn't work out like that. Most of these things had to be fought for, and very frequently they were fought for by marginal and sidelined minorities and intellectual movements in the West. So I think the criticism of cultural superiority is a serious one, but it can be addressed when you pick apart the origins within the West of those virtues and commitments.
If not the caricature depicted by Professor Pinker, what is the Enlightenment and modernity? I think you'd want to talk about enlightenments, wouldn't you?
Yes, historians talk about enlightenments, so French, British and American enlightenment, a moderate enlightenment, a radical enlightenment. They all have different things. Some of them, the French certainly, and the radical were more anti-clerical, so they are more explicitly atheistic movements against religion. Others, like the moderate enlightenment, certainly like the British enlightenment, which influenced the American enlightenment, were nothing like as anti-clerical. But what they did was try to appropriate and engage with reason outside of an immediate confessional framework, an immediate even theological framework sometimes. So some enlightenments were anti-religious, some were kind of religious in a tepid way, but what they sought to do, as I said, was appropriate some of the institutions and ideas that had existed beforehand and think through human destiny by sidestepping some theological questions.
How do you account for the lag between early Christianity and the rise of modern science post-Reformation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The first answer is quite simply the collapse of Western civilization. For people living in 6th century France, the possibility of the scientific method really wasn't high up on their agenda. It's a very serious point. Society utterly collapsed. There is a second point, which I think has to be acknowledged. To quote, I think it's Tertullian, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem? In other words, what has philosophical practice and reasoning got to do with revelation? And there is certainly a powerful movement in the Church Fathers that effectively associates philosophy with paganism and paganism with something that is supplanted by revelation. So, anachronistically, you might say there are anti-scientific currents in the Church Fathers that also act as a deterrent. I think those two factors probably play the greatest role.
Mm-hmm. We've got lots coming in now. That's good. Since Judaism, Islam, and Christianity share the same historical God, does the future of Western value lie in the balance of these three?
I'm not quite sure what balance means there. It certainly lies in the communication between them, and more broadly, little example here, 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights. It's a minor miracle that so many countries agree to it. And Jacques Maritain, who's a French Thomist philosopher who was very influential at that period, in particular with the idea of rights, and who was involved with this whole process, once made the point, he asked somebody whether certainly from a non-Western country, why would you agree with it? And they said, we will agree with it as long as you don't ask us the reasons why. In other words, we have our own logic and approach to this, to the extent that we are prepared to agree with these principles of human rights, and they're different from yours. Now, I think that approach actually is a relevant one to today. We live in a deeply plural and divided world, and people have different metaphysical foundations and beliefs and so on and so forth. That doesn't mean they necessarily disagree on the ethical and even the political outworkings of those. And so communication about our metaphysical differences, but concentration as well on our ethical similarities, I think, is a positive way forward.
This is a good intellectual exercise to express your what are the greatest weaknesses in your own argument. Are you able to give us that?
I'm reminded of the Trump and Clinton debate. Say something nice about your opponent. Okay, I am my own opponent here.
There are no weaknesses.
I mean, it's rock solid, isn't it? I'm just trying to think through it. Well, okay, this is a tongue-in-cheek answer, forgive me. Christians. By which I mean, you will find Christians in every single generation quoting from Scripture the opposite position to those that I have advocated today. And so you could easily, and I've read books that do so, spin a story that tells you quite how deleterious the effect of Christianity on the West has been. So the question then becomes, why my argument and not theirs? What makes mine better? I guess my argument would be these theological ideas beat those ones. But you can draw more or less anything you want from Scripture, and Christians have done, and they've been faithful Bible-believing Christians in doing so. So I think, in a sense, the tradition of Christianity is its own biggest weakness there.
That's masterfully turning your weakness into a strength. I'm not sure if you've been here long enough to answer this question, but is your impression that Australia is like or unlike the UK in terms of secularism and an eagerness to shed their Christian past?
The honest answer is I don't know. That's a tactful answer as well. I sense culturally that UK and Australia are pretty close cousins, certainly closer than the UK and the US are, and repeatedly, at least British commentators, are always making the comparison across the Atlantic. So I would guess that there is a similarity there.
Mm-hmm. Can you expand more on the way Christian sexual ethics left its mark on our world, or perhaps on the ancient world, and then going forward? I mean, Christian sexual ethics don't get a particularly good rap these days.
They don't, and let's be honest, historically they don't deserve to. And, you know, I'm emphatically not saying that as a kind of a child of the 1960s, let it all hang out type response. You know, here's a sobering fact, here's a counter-argument. By the year 390, homosexuals were being burnt in Rome. We have historical evidence for that. That's horrific. Absolutely horrific. And that was came alongside the belief that slaves should not be sexually abused by their masters. Now, we can all countersign that one, but it had a very, very ugly cousin coming alongside it. And famously, you know, the 1,000 years of Western intellectual history is shaped by Augustine's sexual hang-ups. So you know, it doesn't have a very good reputation, and in many ways it doesn't deserve to have one.
Now, you're a believer. What kind of impact has your study of the history of Christianity had on either supporting or challenging your own faith?
Wow. I once remarked, and I feel this ever stronger now, that I don't know anybody who is a serious student of the Reformation why they are still a Christian. Funnily enough, I'm reading a history of the English Reformation at the moment, and our willingness to kill one another, publicly torture and kill one another because they believe you should wear different clothes, you look back and you think, wow, how did you get that out of Jesus Christ and the gospel of love? And of course, they know the scriptures inside out. So it is immersion in periods of history like that that are the biggest challenge to my faith. At the same time, you get someone like William Tyndale, who's a hero of mine, partly because he's such a brilliant linguist, first translated in the 16th century of the English Bible, and others who are making arguments. Tyndale wasn't making this particular argument, but say making early non-conformists, making arguments for political toleration, which are way ahead of their time. Repeatedly, it is often those who are in the weakest positions of society, those, as I said, who are marginal, who have fought for the things that subsequently became mainstream. Not just Christians, as it happens, but many people. And I find that affirming because Christianity is, if you like, a beckoning to the margins of society, because Jesus Christ lived on the margins of society and didn't seek to impose his will through legislation. So I think there are kind of strands within Christian thought that affirm many of the really core aspects of Scripture that I find encouraging.
It seems like the world is increasingly tribal in light of populist movements in the UK and in the US. Aren't Christians just another tribal bunch?
A lot of the time, yeah. I'm an Anglican. I dislike everyone who's not an Anglican. I mean, there is so much truth in that. This is one of the deep, painful ironies of Christianity, that it becomes its own tribal badge, either as a religion or a denomination or as a splinter sect within that denomination. And we have to be repeatedly hauled over. It's one of the important reasons to actually go back to the scriptures and again, particularly the example and teachings of Christ, hauled back to the point that, let's take the Good Samaritan, a parable I know well, ethnic divisions and religious divisions and cultural divisions should not be a bar to my ethical responsibility to other people. That's one of the many messages you can get out of the parable of the Good Samaritan. In other words, don't be tribal.
You've written about the Good Samaritan and its use and misuse in politics. What's its best use you've seen in politics?
Well, that's a really tough question, Simon, because if you'd asked me how badly it was used, we'd be here for another two or three hours or so.
You've got a whole book on that, right?
I can't give a specific example. There are a few in the book. I suppose that one of the dangers is that it's so often used just simply to mean intervene without arguing how you should intervene and where you should intervene, and that's one of the problem lies. But there have been uses, I think, for example, Pope Francis used it when he visited Lesbos to visit the refugees there. And it has been used in parliamentary debate vis-a-vis our responsibility to refugees and people suffering in the Middle East. That seems to me to come close to a legitimate use of it in politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is modern Christian, says ethos, is the modern Christian ethos in conflict with Voltaire and his fixation on reason?
No. Voltaire had a problem with revelation, but he was a thorough theist. I mean, he hated the atheists far more than the Christians did in the 18th century. I guess the conflict there, and one of the conflicts, genuine conflicts between Christianity and much Enlightenment thought, is that Christianity would argue that reason can only be understood within a particular theological context, can only be legitimized within a particular theological context around the capacities of the human mind and the intelligibility of creation. And that deep, 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 deep down, it rests on faith. And Voltaire, I think, certainly some Enlightenment would say, reason is self-sufficient. You can get from basic logical premises. This was Bertrand Russell's big project. You sort logic out first of all, then you build maths on logic, then you build science on maths, and then you build ethics on science. And this was a massive project. And he got through three volumes, the first layer, and then a man called Kurt Gödel, 20 years later, proved that you can't actually, logic isn't self-sufficient, and the whole tower came toppling down. I think that would be the main difference. It's a commitment to reason, but an understanding of the sufficiency of reason.
This could be a short answer. Have you seen the Frankenstein Chronicles? And if so, can you give a comment about how Christianity is portrayed in this series?
I'm afraid I haven't.
Sorry. So apologies for that one. What are the issues on the margins that Christians should be fighting for today?
I guess it depends the margins of which country. I wrote a book 12 years ago now on asylum and immigration. It was called Asylum and Immigration, A Christian Perspective on a Polarized Debate. I chose that title.
Can someone have helped you with that?
Yeah, you may not have seen that one in the New York Times bestseller list. At the time, there was hysteria, I think is not too exaggerated a word, about asylum seekers in the press because there were some bogus asylum seekers. And I tried to make the point, actually, from scriptural grounds, that this was really problematic and that a country should be proud of the way it treats the people who seek asylum there. I don't think there are many more things that you can be morally proud of as a society than the way you welcome people who really need a welcome. And that remains even more the case today, particularly in Europe, than it was when I wrote that book 13 years ago. So I would put that as one. I would carefully disambiguate asylum from immigration. They are different issues and they can have different ethical responses. But I think the treatment of people who are properly driven from all home and comfort would be one of those issues.
Well, there was a question here related to that. And you spoke about utilitarianism. It's not always bad, is it? But as it's applied to some of these policies, sometimes it might leave something to be desired.
No, it certainly isn't bad. And I guess I did think about that when I was writing the lecture. And you can come away from this thinking, God, he really hates utilitarians, doesn't he? And I don't want to entirely rag on it. You know, it is recognised that you cannot effectively make issues around, say, medical ethics without resorting to some utilitarian grounds. How much good is it going to do this person? And how much is the treatment going to cost? And how many other people won't be treated because of this treatment? And how many years of life does this person have? They are all perfectly legitimate calculations. The critical thing, particularly with medical ethics, was that up until actually quite recently, and certainly in the US, they were the sole ones, as opposed to also introducing more humanistic concepts around consent. So it's not that utilitarianism and simply weighing up the good and bad in the situation, the pain and pleasure, it's not that that is illegitimate. It's just that if it's the sole consideration, it becomes problematic.
This is an interesting one for the current society. Did Christianity go too far? It valued human dignity and the individual, but now we have this kind of hyper-individualism and atomized communities and so on, and less of a sense of the common good. Mm. Is that Christianity's fault?
Well, you could say that it was. I would footnote that. Larry Seedentonk's book that I mentioned there is called Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism. And I love the book. I have a problem with the title because much theological thought, particularly in 20th century, tries to distinguish between the individual and the person and argues that a proper Christian anthropology is based on the person rather than the individual. So you could make that point. I would also make the point, as a Protestant myself, that that form of individualism is much more readily rooted into Protestant thought from the 16th and 17th centuries, and to simplify things hugely, it's my relationship with God supremely, independent of any broader ecclesial setting that matters. Now, of course, you can make a very good argument for that, but then if you that multiply that across society and substitute God for anything you think of, then you get individualism. So the roots certainly go back to Protestant Christianity.
Okay, we'll blame them. And we've talked about the current society's definition of freedom as endless and unlimited choice. You feel like there's a poverty in the definition, don't you?
Well, as you know, philosophers much better equipped than me will tell you, freedom is a slippery thing, and it's very important to disambiguate what Isaiah Berlin once called negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from. Positive freedom is freedom to. Freedom from authorities, freedom to do this. Both have a place, but both taken to excess can lead to the kind of individualism and the atomized society that I think can be linked to, you know, problems with regards to mental health and confidence and competitiveness and all the things that we recognise as plaguing contemporary societies.
Okay. You mentioned this in your lecture, but there'll be plenty of people who might think about Christianity and the way it's sort of been both the opponent of freedom and good things as well as the supporter of, and trying to disentangle the fact that just as there were abolitionists who used the Bible to defeat slavery, they were fighting against people who were using the Bible to support it. It's a pretty complex web, isn't it, to try and get your head around.
It really is, and that's why I'm always at pains to emphasise there are arguments on both sides, and there literally were arguments on both sides. The interesting thing, I think, for me, is in these messy debates, when there are abolitionists arguing for abolition from Scripture, and slave traders arguing for slavery from Scripture. And indeed, the first example, there are people who have different views on slavery in the ancient world. Why is it that one side ultimately wins out over the other? Sometimes, I think you can certainly make this case from the abolitionist case, it is because the weight of Scripture wins out There are arguments on both sides, but one is heavier and the scales tip. I think you can make that argument, albeit in a much longer way, with regards to practice of the early church. It's fundamentally quite difficult to kneel next to the same person week in, week out, and share the same bread and drink the same cup, and then return to a situation in which you are very clearly superior in owning them. It becomes difficult. However, I think it's also fair to say that one of the genuinely positive points, and one point I do agree with Steven Pinker, is that what the Enlightenment sees is a slight shift, a noticeable shift away from, if you like, eternal contentment to temporal contentment. It's not the case that temporal happiness doesn't exist beforehand. That's transparently not the case. But it is also the case that Enlightenment philosophers place a greater emphasis on how we can live happily today than Christian forebears did, and that helps tip Christians towards a more humanistic ethic.
Okay. Just a couple more. Is the idea of the Judeo-Christian values and the Christian influence on society an irredeemably right-wing cause?
You've rumbled me. No, emphatically not. And goodness me, let's hope that it doesn't become one. If it becomes politicised, it's doomed. Little illustration. Britain never developed a Christian political party because in one sense it had three Christian political parties. The Tories were the Anglicans, Labour, nonconformist, and Catholic, liberal, very much nonconformist. There were Christians across the political spectrum right the way from the 1850s onwards, and that was one of the reasons why that history, British social and political history since that time, was transparently much more stable than much other European history, because there were Christians found across the political spectrum. I think you turn this round here, and you can, and this is a Christian argument, but if you have people across the political spectrum appropriating this argument, it stops it from becoming a politicised argument.
One of our guests would like to know, what are you going to write about next?
So I just, before I came out here, learned that we've got a grant to do a big project on science and religion. So my hope is that I can write something substantial on science and religion with two aspects to it. One, looking at this question in a bit more detail about why it was the Christian cultures of the 17th century that helped foster science in the way that China and ancient Greece and 9th century Arabia, and indeed 14th century Paris and Oxford got some of the way, but not all of the way. But then also to tell the post-17th century story and to try and build on the work of some brilliant people like Peter Harrison, who's lectured here, Stephen Gaukroger, John Headley Brooke, and to tell a more nuanced story of the fact that it wasn't simply either or, as much more complexity. So it's hopefully it's going to be science and religion.
Now, one final question. What's the single greatest gift of Christianity to the world?
There's a kind of really pious answer here, but I would kind of avoid that and go back to what I said in the lecture about this concept of the value of the human. And almost, and I'm struck by this, almost at the centre of a settlement is a building of common usage, relational building in theory, and at the centre of that building is the image of a person, and that person is being tortured to death, is the lowest of the low, and that is the focus of our common life, and it reinforces in a visceral way, which is not simply a high culture way or a low culture way, it's a universal way, pointing towards the value of and the responsibilities we owe one another.
So the low point becomes the high point.
That's almost biblical, Simon.
Thank you. Nick, it's so great to have you here. Not all of us can be, or perhaps are interested in being, experts in 12th century canon law.
It's gripping, I tell you.
Glad someone is, and you've been able to bring all that wisdom tonight. We thank Nick Spencer.
You've been listening to the 2018 Richard Johnson Lecture Q&A session with Nick Spencer and Simon Smart. Nick is Research Director of Theos Think Tank in London. He's written for The Guardian and The Telegraph and has been described by The Economist as like a prophet crying in the postmodern wilderness. Nick is the author of several books, including Atheists, The Origin of the Species, and The Evolution of the West, How Christianity Has Shaped Our Values. Do also check out our other podcast, Life and Faith. It's a wide-ranging weekly conversation about how Christianity interrogates and illuminates the world we live in. You can find Life and Faith wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.